KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A judge tells the federal government not to deport an activist until his case is aired out in court. What free speech protections, if any, come along with his green card? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration wants more control over the Postal Service. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The administration even talks of having postal workers conduct the census in between mail deliveries. NPR ran the numbers on that idea. 5 years ago today, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. This hour, we hear what a California public health official says she learned and ask if we're any better prepared. It's Tuesday, March 11th. This day in 1918, doctors confirmed the first U.S. cases of what became a pandemic, influenza. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Congress has until late Friday night to pass a short-term spending bill to avert a partial shutdown of the federal government. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports a vote in the House is likely today on a bill to fund federal agencies through September.
House Speaker Mike Johnson unveiled a spending bill over the weekend that continues current funding levels for most federal agencies, but boosts money for immigration enforcement and defense programs. If all Democrats vote no, House GOP leaders will need almost all Republicans to support the legislation. President Trump endorsed the measure. If the bill passes the House, Senate Republicans will need support from some Democrats to approve the bill before the midnight deadline on Friday to avoid a shutdown. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
Stocks opened mixed this morning after a big sell-off yesterday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 200 points in early trading.
A new survey of small business owners finds their outlook has been rattled in recent weeks. The NFIB's uncertainty index rose to its second highest reading ever. Compared to January, fewer small businesses say now is a good time to expand, but more say they plan to raise prices. Stock in Southwest Airlines took off after the carrier announced plans to join the rest of the pack and start charging for checked bags this summer. Delta shares, on the other hand, descended after the company warned of weaker travel demand. President Trump's trade war is raising electricity bills for 1.5 million power customers in the U.S. who get their kilowatts from Canada. In response to Trump's tariff threats, Ontario has added a tax on electric exports. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Military chiefs from more than 30 European countries are meeting in Paris today. They're talking about forming an international security force to support Ukraine. NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris. Their goal is to help enforce a possible ceasefire and stop future Russian attacks on Ukraine.
European military leaders are working on a plan for what British Prime Minister Keir Starmer calls a coalition of the willing, a joint force of European and NATO countries aimed at reassuring Ukraine and deterring Russia after a ceasefire. But there's one key NATO member missing from today's talks, the United States. A French official told the Associated Press the U.S. wasn't invited because European nations want to show they can take the lead in securing Ukraine's future. Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea are tuning in remotely. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
The military talks in Paris come as Secretary of State Marco Rubio meets with top Ukrainian leaders in Saudi Arabia. They're talking about ways to end the war with Russia. Rubio says he wants to learn if Ukraine is prepared to do difficult things. He says Russia will have to do them, too, to end the war. Ukraine's president is pushing President Trump for U.S. security guarantees. You're listening to NPR. People in Greenland are voting in parliamentary elections today. The self-governing region of Denmark will choose members of the legislature. Greenland's been moving toward independence for several years, but President Trump has been saying he wants the U.S. to take it over, but then says Greenlanders should decide for themselves. Officials in California, Nevada, and Arizona have written to the Trump administration. They're asking officials to examine the future management of the Colorado River. From member station KUNC, Alex Hager reports this comes amid negotiations over how much water the federal government will allocate to each state.
Those states say the previous administration didn't do enough to seriously consider their water management proposal. This letter to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum says states are still working amongst themselves to collaborate on a new plan for sharing water. Michael Cohen, who studies the river with the nonprofit Pacific Institute, says that might not be enough.
There needs to be a clear federal voice calling for all seven states to come to a consensus agreement. And I think the basin states have been successful in the past when they've received that kind of threat. There needs to be this credible threat.
The river supplies tens of millions of people across the West, and the current rules for sharing its water expire in 2026. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
The Trump administration is proposing to end enrollment early for next year's health care plans covered by the Affordable Care Act. Government officials would cut the enrollment period by one full month. People who want to sign up for the health care plans would need to do so by December 15th. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, the rebels who captured Syria's capital expand their control over more of the country. We begin, though, with a story closer to home.
A federal judge in New York ordered the government not to deport a college protest leader who was arrested by immigration officers over the weekend.
Mahmoud Khalil is a lawful permanent resident of the United States, a recent graduate of Columbia University. He was sent to a detention center in Louisiana to await deportation after his arrest at his university housing on Saturday.
NPR's Ryland Barton has been following the story and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just getting my brain around the idea that he was taken out of New York and taken all the way to Louisiana. So what all's going on here?
Right. So Khalil's attorneys filed a habeas corpus petition in federal court in New York. They're challenging his arrest, and we now know there will be a hearing on that on Wednesday. As you said, he's still in detention in Louisiana. His lawyers are trying to get him back to New York. They say that his transfer down there undermines his ability to access legal counsel and his family. President Trump wrote on social media that Khalil's arrest was the first arrest of many to come. He said there are students at Columbia and other universities engaged in, quote, pro-terrorist, anti-Semitic, anti-American activity. Khalil's attorneys say the Trump administration is using him as an example to stifle lawful dissent, which violates the First Amendment. Khalil's wife, who's pregnant, also issued a statement asking for help to bring him back home. She described him as a loving husband and the future father of their baby and someone who's always willing to stand up for the oppressed.
Since you brought up the First Amendment, what does the law say about how that applies specifically to a green card holder? And how does all that match up with the facts of this case?
So green card holders have many of the same protections that U.S. citizens have, but they can be deported for certain reasons, committing crimes, not updating immigration officials on their whereabouts, for example. The administration says that since Khalil was one of the student leaders active in those protests opposing Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza, he violated the administration's ban on anti-Semitism and supported a group considered to be a terrorist organization by the U.S., and that's grounds for deportation to them. Trump officials have made several statements about this over the week. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on social media that the administration would revoke the visas or green cards of Hamas supporters so that they can be deported.
How does this fit with the larger policies of the administration? The U.S. Education Department, I know, is telling dozens of universities they're under investigation for anti-Semitism as the administration sees it.
Right. The department's new secretary, Linda McMahon, told 60 colleges and universities they could lose funding depending on the outcome of investigations they've launched into anti-Semitism on their campuses. This letter they sent out to them also warned that they could lose federal funding if they don't do more to combat anti-Semitism. This list includes a wide range of Ivy League schools like Yale, state schools like Arizona State, small liberal arts colleges like Middlebury College in Vermont. And it comes after the administration canceled almost $400 million in federal funding for Columbia University, accusing it of allowing persistent harassment of Jewish students.
NPR's Ryland Barton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more on Khalil's case and the rights of green card holders, we have Stuart Anderson. He is executive director of the National Foundation for American Policy, a free market think tank. He previously was the head of policy at what used to be called the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. So, Stuart, what rights come with a green card?
Well, while the term is used, lawful permanent resident, you actually can be deported for a number of reasons, certainly if you commit a crime. And what's happened here is they're trying to use a provision of the law that's really just about never been used to deport someone, certainly a green card holder, in which under the law it says an alien whose presence or activities in the United States, the Secretary of State has reasonable ground to believe would have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences, that person is deportable. And that raises the issue that anyone who is a green card holder or another non-citizen could be deported for criticizing the president's foreign policy.
So, wow. Okay, so just criticizing foreign policy is enough. You don't need to have any more evidence of a crime or anything like that.
That's correct. I mean, the statute is written that way. It has been used, and there was an administrative ruling that the proof administratively within the Immigration Service, it's sufficient simply a letter from the Secretary of State saying that their presence would have adverse consequences is sufficient proof, at least administratively. And so what we're going to have to see is if this is challenged on Bill of Rights grounds, whether the entire provision will be viewed as constitutional.
But the protections that go along with a green card, what are they exactly? I mean, what would be there that could actually help someone that has a green card?
Well, what would probably help the most is that there was a Supreme Court case in 1945 called Bridges v. Wixon, in which there was a labor organizer who was an immigrant who was accused of being a member of the Communist Party. He denied being a member, and he essentially was able to stay in the country and not be deported because the majority opinion said that freedom of speech and the press is accorded aliens residing in the country. And it also said that once an alien lawfully enters and resides in the country, he becomes invested with the rights guaranteed by the Constitution that are available to everyone within the borders. So that's, I think, what an attorney would want to hang their hat on.
Yeah. So how much authority does the judge have to uphold proceedings here?
Well, the normal process is that someone would first go through an immigration judge, and then they would be either deported or not deported or issued an order to be deported. And then at that point, then it would be challenged for on whatever grounds an attorney decides to challenge it. In this case, a judge is just trying to, I think, at least preserve that opportunity to appeal any administrative decision.
Is the reason why Khalil is in Louisiana maybe to try and find a more conservative-leaning judge?
Well, there's no doubt that the administration knew that this was going to be challenged on constitutional grounds. And so it certainly made more sense to be in Louisiana than in New York or New Jersey. But I think, you know, we're going to have to see how widely this authority is used.
So when you first heard of this story, I mean, what did you think? I mean, your experience with all this, what were your first impressions?
Well, the first impression I had is that anytime an authority is used against one group, it can be used against another group later on. And so right now, this is being used against someone who's critical of policy towards Israel. But in 10 or 15 years, you might have a different president who does not support Israel. And if you had people criticizing that policy, would you want those individuals to be deported?
Stuart Anderson of the National Foundation for American Policy. Stuart, thanks.
Thank you.
Syria's new government has taken a step toward unifying its control of the country. They made a deal with Kurdish groups. These are groups with U.S. backing who have controlled a lot of territory in the northeast of Syria. The Kurdish rebels signed a deal on Monday to merge with the Syrian army, and in return they are promised full rights as Syrian citizens. NPR's Jane Araf reports.
For many Kurds, it was a low-key end to a decades-long dream. The commander of the Kurdish-led forces and the interim Syrian president, the Syrian flag behind them, signed a two-page document aimed at bringing the Kurdish region back under federal control. The commander, Mazlum Abdi, wore the suit of a politician rather than his military uniform. Abdi heads the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces. His group fought alongside U.S. forces to defeat ISIS. The Kurds broke away from Syrian regime control to create a secular, multi-ethnic, semi-autonomous region in 2012, but they have always been under threat. The biggest threat was from Turkey, where the government has seen Kurdish aspirations as a danger to its own country. Northeast Syria is a main oil-producing region, and it's also the traditional breadbasket in Syria. Details of the agreement, reported by Syrian Kurdish media, include sharing the Kurdish region's resources, while allowing the SDF to still administer much of their territory. The United States had a big role in this. U.S. military officials have said since the fall of the regime last December that the Kurds would need to come to an agreement with Syria. The United States has 2,000 troops in the country, and it's unclear whether they will stay. One of the main threats to the stability of this new Syria is fighting between Kurdish forces and Turkish-backed Syrian militias who helped topple the former regime. Turkish-backed Syria TV, close to the new Syrian government, reported that Sharaa agreed to enshrine Kurdish cultural and linguistic rights in the new constitution. Kurdish media, controlled by the SDF, said the agreement over the coming year would merge civil and military institutions within the federal system and provide joint protection against foreign groups. They said it also included cooperation in fighting ISIS. The agreement was welcomed by many Arab tribes, now under Kurdish-led control, but mourned by many Kurds who see it as Turkey, with U.S. help, engineering the end of Kurdish self-rule in Syria. Jane Araf, NPR News, Damascus.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times editor David Enrich joins us to discuss his new book, Murder the Truth. It chronicles a campaign by billionaires, politicians, and corporations to silence journalists and undermine free speech protections. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE, price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. 5 years ago today, Americans began seeing how a virus that had been detected in Wuhan, China, was about to reshape everyday life. On March 11th, 2020, the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, held a news conference.
We have made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
The Dow tanked its worst day since Black Monday in 1987.
Live pictures again of the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ market site here, with the Dow falling over 1,000 points, the WHO declaring COVID-19 a pandemic.
That night, 5 years ago, at the Chesapeake Arena in Oklahoma City, the doctor for the Oklahoma City Thunder ran onto the court just as the team was preparing to face the Utah Jazz. NBA fans watched with bewilderment as coaches and referees huddled.
The officials now appear to be clearing the floor. Both teams have gone back to the locker room.
Watching that game on TV, Steve, I got to admit, that freaked me out. Yeah. Later, Utah Jazz All-Star center Rudy Gobert tested positive for coronavirus. The NBA suspended its entire season. That night, President Trump went on TV. He said his administration would get the outbreak under control and he announced new travel restrictions.
To keep new cases from entering our shores, we will be suspending all travel from Europe to the United States for the next 30 days.
The travel ban prompted rebuke from the European Union and stirred even more confusion, because at that point the public didn't know very much about the origins of the virus or how to stop it from spreading. The WHO estimates that by the end of that year, 2020, COVID-19 had killed at least 3 million people worldwide.
And one of the earliest first responders in one of the early epicenters of the pandemic was Dr. Sarah Cody. She is the health officer and director of public health for California's Santa Clara County. She spoke with our co-host Michelle Martin about issuing what's considered the country's first order for people to stay home.
We were initially talking about how we needed to pick one standard around the Bay Area about what the gathering limit size should be. But we quickly realized that we were having the wrong conversation and that we needed to be talking about shelter in place. And this happened very quickly over a weekend.
Well, say more about what was going on that triggered that. Like, what did it look like there?
What happened was, in the first 2 weeks of March, we were finally able to test more widely. Remember, the CDC test rollout was fraught. So during the first 2 weeks of March, we finally saw what had probably been happening for many weeks. We had imperfect information, but we had enough information to know that the virus was spreading like wildfire. And we also knew that we didn't have very many tools available, because remember, at that time, there was very little personal protective equipment. There were no therapies. There was no vaccine on the horizon. And so there were almost no tools that we could turn to. And we decided to issue a shelter in place.
How long did you think that the shelter-in-place order was going to last?
Well, it's really funny to admit this, but I honestly, we issued it, and it was for 3 weeks. And somehow I had this magical thinking that, you know, maybe something would change. Maybe we'll have to extend it by a little. But never did I imagine that it would need to be in place for as long as it was.
And of course, as it went on, there came to be a lot of pressure to reopen. And, you know, let's just be honest, there were conflicting messages. Did it feel that way to you?
Yeah, it was a tough communication environment, for sure. We had some advantages in the Bay Area. And by and large, the public in the Bay Area understood what we were doing, understood why it was necessary. There were certainly exceptions, but for the most part, the public appreciated what we were doing and stayed with us for a very long time.
You know, some of the public health professionals who were particularly visible started to have security.
So I was with an armed sheriff for almost 18 months. Protesters did come to my home with increasing frequency and frequently at night, and they were very loud and very disruptive.
Just looking back now, and I realize that this is hard to do, but are there any aspects of the decisions that you made that you now think were incorrect?
Honestly, the decision that felt most clean and that I would make again and again and again was the shelter in place. I think the much more complicated decisions were around reopening, and it was, what do you reopen, when, and how to get input and from whom on making those decisions. That was enormously, enormously complex.
Do you think something has fundamentally changed for you and for other professionals like you as a result of that experience?
Yes, I think many public health professionals at every level of public health were really traumatized by that period. And I am in awe of colleagues who did what they did with less support than I had.
How do you think this experience may have changed the way the country may face a future pandemic?
Honestly, I'm quite worried. I think that we are in a much weaker position now for a variety of reasons than we were 5 years ago. And I think that we're going to have to face it in a different way. Local is important. That's where the rubber hits the road. That's where you can make change. That's where you can be nimble. I don't have the answers, but we're in a really, really, really tough place right now. The country is incredibly polarized. We've had this like radical change in norms about how we behave and how we speak with each other and how we solve problems together. We need coalitions of like-minded people to express themselves and try to make change.
That is Dr. Sarah Cody. She's health officer and public health director for Santa Clara County in California. Dr. Cody, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
The COVID-19 virus today is not exactly the same one that began the pandemic 5 years ago.
I thought it would undergo some evolution, but the speed at which it's undergone that evolution and the ability it's shown to undergo these big evolutionary jumps is really remarkable.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A look at how COVID and our immunity to it has changed on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Stocks on Wall Street moved lower this morning after President Trump said he's adding an additional 25% tariff on all steel and aluminum imports from Canada. That raises the total tariffs on those goods to 50%. Michael Gapin is the chief U.S. economist for Morgan Stanley. He was asked about the possibility of the U.S. entering a recession.
The combination of policies
tariffs, spending cuts, immigration controls, all tend to soften activity in the near term. So if you put all of those in place, I think you do have to conclude recession odds have risen. Whether we get one or not is, I think, still open for debate.
Trump says the move is in response to Ontario placing a 25% tariff on electricity coming to the U.S. A fire continues burning off England's northeast coast following yesterday's collision between a cargo ship and a tanker. Here's NPR's Lauren Frayer.
The jet fuel in the North Sea is from a huge gash on the side of a tanker that had been ferrying fuel for the U.S. military. The cargo ship was also carrying toxic chemicals. Coast Guard aircraft are spraying dispersants on the water around the wreckage and have deployed floating booms to prevent the spill from spreading. Marine accident investigators have arrived from the U.S. and Portugal, the countries where the ships were flagged.
This is NPR News. Congress is facing a Friday night deadline to pass a spending bill to avert a partial shutdown of the federal government. The House is expected to vote on a spending bill today. Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk is calling for more respect between allies. It follows a heated exchange on social media between U.S. and Polish officials about Starlink, the company owned by Elon Musk's SpaceX. Esme Nicholson has more.
Tusk has appealed on X for friends to refrain from insulting each other. This after billionaire Elon Musk referred to Poland's foreign minister Radoslaw Sikorski as a small man. Musk also instructed him to be quiet in an exchange about Ukraine's continued use of Starlink satellites. Secretary of State Marco Rubio also wrote on X, Poland should say thank you for Starlink because without it, he continued, the Russians would be on the border with Poland right now. On Friday, Tusk told Parliament that all adult men in Poland will receive military training, announced plans to withdraw from international treaties banning the use of landmines, and the need to acquire nuclear warheads. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
Doctors in Rome say Pope Francis is no longer in imminent danger of death from pneumonia. The 88-year-old pontiff remains hospitalized for double pneumonia, but his prognosis has been upgraded. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 439 points, or more than 1%. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. President Trump's tariffs and his remarks about a recession led to the worst day for the stock markets this year.
Now, the Dow tracks 30 major U.S. companies. It fell 2%, almost 900 points. The broader NASDAQ and S&P 500 are also sharply down. Now, these things always move up and down, but the markets overall have given back all their gains since last November's election and then some.
And NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is following all of this. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so why was there such a big drop yesterday?
Well, President Trump has done and said a lot of different things about tariffs in the past week, and investors have been feeling the whiplash. Just to recap, Steve, Trump's new 25% taxes on imports from Canada and Mexico went into effect last week. Then he started giving out reprieves, first to automakers, then to Mexico, then to Canada.
Yeah.
But the fact that Trump actually let the tariffs go into effect was a big deal and showed they might be more than just a negotiating tactic. And he's continuing to talk about them happening long term, despite all the warnings about how much they could hurt the U.S. economy. This all really hit home on Sunday. Fox News anchor Maria Bartiromo aired an interview with Trump, and this was the bit that got everyone worried.
Are you expecting a recession this year?
I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition because what we're doing is very big. We're bringing wealth back to America. That's a big thing.
So Trump didn't rule out the possibility of a recession. Now, it's important to note that his Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, did. He told NBC News in a different interview that there's, quote, no chance of a recession. But yesterday, Wall Street seemed to be listening to Trump, not Lutnick.
I guess we should just state the reality. There's always a chance of a recession. You would hope it would be in the future, but you don't know. I'm also thinking about the narrative that you lay out there, Maria, and it's not solely the threat of Trump's, but also the unpredictability. They're on, they're off, they're sideways. You just don't know. So how concerned should investors be?
Well, one of the big concerns over tariffs is that they could really hike the prices consumers pay for everything from cars to groceries. That'll contribute to inflation and hurt the wider economy. And we've seen companies, including Target and Best Buy, warn that, yeah, tariffs are going to lead to higher prices. So that's a huge consideration for consumers and for consumer-facing businesses. And then, as you point out, Steve, all of the back and forth with tariff policy has created a lot of swings in the stock market, and that volatility makes it hard to plan for both consumers and investors. I talked about this last week with Anna Tavis. She's a management professor at NYU, where she talks to executives across corporate America.
Businesses don't like uncertainty.
And now we're starting to see that uncertainty creeping across our economy. For example, yesterday Delta Airlines cut its forecast, citing reduced consumer and corporate confidence and economic uncertainty.
I noticed that some stocks are doing worse than others. The tech-heavy NASDAQ had its worst day in years. Is something else going on in the economy we should worry about?
So tech companies like Apple and Nvidia are some of the hottest stocks, so they're also the most expensive, and some of their losses may have just been investors realizing we're spending too much for what we're getting. But Trump's comments over the weekend really seem to signal a shift in how he thinks about the market. He used to really rely on the market's performance as a kind of proxy approval rating, and now he seems to be signaling that he's more focused on tariffs, even if the market is unhappy, and even if they cause more immediate economic pain.
And NPR's Maria Aspen, thanks for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has two controversial proposals about the Postal Service: fold USPS, which is independent, into the White House, and have mail carriers conduct the upcoming 2030 census. NPR's Hanzi Lo Wong explains how the ideas are connected.
In a recent Fox News interview, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said he came up with the concept of having his department take control of the Postal Service after President Trump asked him to solve the mail service's long-standing financial problems.
You know, he gives me a whole 24 hours to figure it out. And I said, well, the Commerce Department does the census.
That's, of course, the once-a-decade headcount of the country's residents that's used to redistribute political representation and federal funding. And Lutnick's pitch was, instead of hiring temporary census workers,
can you imagine saying to your postman, can you count the people in the house?
That question has been floating in Congress for decades.
Can we also utilize the man knocking on the door?
I do think the Postal Service is an unused government resource. It could be of more help to the census.
That was from a House hearing in 2017 with then-Republican Representatives Rod Blum and Blake Farenthold. Details about Secretary Lutnick's proposal are not public. The Commerce Department and Postal Service did not respond to interview requests. But census consultant Terry Ann Lowenthal says when it comes to trying to reduce costs and improve the count's accuracy,
there are no silver bullets.
The 2020 census cost around $14 billion. But Lutnick claimed replacing census workers with mail carriers could save the government $40 billion.
The cost savings that Secretary Lutnick believes might be there for the taking simply are based on wildly inaccurate numbers and assumptions.
One assumption is that it would be relatively easy to squeeze census interviews into a mail carrier's day.
You know, mail is obviously, in most cases, delivered during the day, in the middle of the day.
Chris Mim tracked the census for decades at the Government Accountability Office.
That's not the peak time for doing follow-up on census forms that are not returned. In fact, the Census Bureau discourages an awful lot of that. That's when people are at work, obviously.
In 2011, the GAO found it's not cost-effective to replace census workers with higher-paid mail carriers. Still, the heads of the three postal service unions NPR talked to say they're open to taking on more census work, but they're also on guard because at a press conference in December, President Trump said there's talk about privatizing the postal service.
You do know that. Not the worst idea I've ever heard.
Trump has also said his administration is considering a form of a merger between the Postal Service and the Commerce Department. It's a move that will likely spark a lawsuit, says Rena Steinzer, an administrative law expert who recently retired from the University of Maryland's law school.
To pull it into the Commerce Department and get rid, in essence, of its independent structure would not be legal without the consent of Congress.
Mark Dimenstein, president of the American Postal Workers Union, says he's concerned the Trump administration's plans will lead to more cuts in mail service for the public.
The people of this country should not be fooled by nice-sounding ideas of doing a census as if somehow that's a basis or legitimate reason to do a hostile takeover.
There is a less disruptive path for the administration. The Postal Service's governing board is set to pick a new postmaster general, and the board has three open seats. But so far, the White House has not said whether the president is planning to nominate any postal governors. Anzila Wong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
We know Peter Wolf from the Jay Giles Band, but his new memoir describes the incredible encounters in his storied life next time here and now.
Appointments get canceled, plans fall through, but NPR is always there with news you can trust live at the top of every hour. Listen on your phone at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep with a book recommendation. Mary Cooper of New Jersey found a library book while cleaning. It's been overdue for 99 years. Her grandfather checked it out. It's called Homemade Toys for Girls and Boys. Grandfather was a boatwright and carpenter and built toy wooden sailboats for Mary's mother. Now the book is back where it belongs, so if you are looking for the sequel to Handicraft for Handy Boys, it is now on display at her local library. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. As you may know, Congress wants to cut health care costs, and some lawmakers contend that one way to do that is for doctors to have more nutrition training to better fight diseases like diabetes. How that's taught is up to each medical school. Corey Young of Alabama Public Radio sat in on one class in a kitchen.
Olives, zucchini, mushrooms, and whole wheat dough sit on the island of the teaching kitchen at the University of South Alabama. A group of medical students wearing crisp white aprons crowd around the ingredients. They're here to learn how to cook food as medicine. Connor Martin plans to be an internist, but says he was in the dark when talking with patients about diet.
I would give them like pamphlets and stuff, but I would not really be able to like go in depth and explain it. And so that's why this course has been really helpful and exciting.
Today's lesson is carbohydrates. One of the teachers is physiology professor David Weber. He throws out some staggering numbers.
Average person in the U.S. eats 100 pounds of sugar per year.
100 pounds. The students are shocked. That's the reaction Weber hopes to get from his students. The idea is if doctors realize what their patients eat, they can ask better questions and give advice. As they work on their pizzas, Rachel Motamed tells her classmates about the last homework assignment, which was to cook something healthy.
I made a kale salad.
Oh, no way. Motamed wants to go into psychiatry. She's been in this class for a month and says she gets it.
I want to emphasize like nutrition and wellness as a means of medicine, not just like a supplement to a medication.
That's the message Dr. David Eisenberg hopes all doctors understand. Eisenberg is director of culinary nutrition at Harvard. He was part of a group of medical professionals who published more than 30 nutrition competencies they want medical students to be tested on.
These are no longer competencies that are nice to have. They're competencies that one must have.
They include things like how to talk about food with sensitivity, understand the difference between minimally processed and ultra-processed foods, or explain food labels to patients. But they're far from becoming a requirement.
So we really eat the entire plant.
Back in the kitchen, the pizzas are in the oven, and it's time to make the salad. Dr. Bob Israel is showing students how to slice a fennel bulb to mix with oranges.
It's not a vegetable. You want to put a big old chunk of it.
He's the director of this kitchen and says teaching med students to cook is a lot like surgery. It's hard to tell someone how to cut a tomato or an onion, but
if they see it done and then do it themselves, it's a lot easier for them to envision themselves doing it.
The pizza is done.
That's pretty.
For Connor Martin, the class was enlightening, and a lot surprised him.
Oof. Honestly, a lot of the things that are in our foods that I wish I did not know, but I know now.
And now he may tell his future patients what's in their food. For NPR News, I'm Corey Young in Mobile, Alabama.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. Each day you wake up, whatever. Anyway, we bring you the facts when we can pronounce them. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
More tariffs, more market trauma.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Lisa. Lisa believes that a better night's sleep should be available to everyone. Since 2015, Lisa has donated over 41,000 mattresses to shelters and those in need. Learn more at leesa.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore in for David Brancaccio. Markets started off calm this morning, but are now officially having another rough day. Starting shortly after President Donald Trump announced he was doubling tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum, already set to go into effect tomorrow. He said this was in response to Canadian tariffs that were in response to U.S. tariffs. That is what you call a trade war, folks. The Dow is down 526 points. That is 1.2%. The NASDAQ is down 1.2%. The S&P 500 down 0.9%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury also creeping down. It's 4.214%. Joining us to talk about this is Jeffrey Cleveland. He's chief economist at Payden and Riegel. Good morning.
Good morning, Sabri.
The market reaction that we've seen so far that we saw yesterday, do you think it's over or do you think there's more in store?
It's possible there's more in store. I mean, we have a lot of uncertainty, whether it's tariffs, government spending cuts, layoffs. I think investors are just very concerned about what the growth consequences of this policy mix might be.
Yeah, I mean, is it all sort of fear around tariffs, or is it the government layoffs, or is it something else?
I think it's a combination of all that, plus some of the data that we've seen in recent weeks has been weaker than expected. So we had some concerns about jobs. We have seen some estimates for first quarter gross domestic product in the U.S. showing contraction last week. That's created this sense in markets and in the minds of investors that the economy is shrinking or on the verge of shrinking. And I think you see that reflected in things like equity markets.
What data are we going to need to see to understand whether this reaction, these fears are founded or not?
Well, I think people need to take a deep breath and think about, you know, as recently as last summer, we had what I would call a bit of a growth scare where we had some weaker jobs numbers, some downward revisions to payrolls. And, you know, the Federal Reserve was concerned enough to cut the federal funds rate by 0.5%. I think that was quickly forgotten in the fall because the data rebounded. And I think importantly, Sabri, will be the jobs data. So if we continue to see job growth, that will be a very good sign. And also spending. We saw some weak consumer spending to start 2025. But as we get more data throughout the quarter, we could see the spending rebounding. And I think that will provide some calm for markets.
Jeffrey Cleveland, chief economist at Payden and Riegel. Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful week.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Baird. Baird strives to attract and retain top financial professionals, providing stability and continuity of advice for clients across market environments. More information at BairdDifference.com.
This week marks 5 years since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. Economic reality seemed to change overnight as the virus spread. And despite a very strong recovery, we are still dealing with some of the consequences. Inflation is still on its way back down. To take a look back at some of the enduring economic marks left by the pandemic, we're joined by Pavlina Chernova. She's the president of the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We did get new and expanded forms of government relief and service during the pandemic. Did any of that stick, or really did that change at all what Americans expect from their government?
We were able to really mobilize the public resources, and I'm talking about financial resources, research capabilities, administrative structures. We were able to mobilize them to, you know, develop, obviously, vaccines. We offered telehealth. We offered, you know, various other subsidies. And so I think people understood for a brief moment that this was possible, and those protections then disappeared, and they were left to struggle with high healthcare bills and the kind of difficulty to access healthcare, as one example.
There were and are differences of opinions on the effectiveness of some of the things the government did. For example, relief payments. On the one hand, they provided much needed relief to people. On the other, people say that they contributed to inflation. I'm wondering, what mistakes did we or could we learn from an economic perspective?
I mean, I think the first lesson is that income support, relief payments, clearly can be dispersed on short order. But I think what it also demonstrated is that just income support doesn't really address the fundamental structural issues that we're discussing here. Income support doesn't increase the minimum wage. You have to have minimum wage legislation to do that. You have to have legislation to provide benefits for working people. And I think this is where we missed an opportunity to think very deeply about transforming the labor market. There was, I think, a missed opportunity on extending the expanded child tax credits. We could have tried different types of student debt relief when student debt cancellation didn't work. We've seen homelessness increase, you know, thinking about housing issues. And so I think that income was the expedient thing to do, but it was not a transformative thing to do.
Mm. Well, if there is, you know, political disagreement about whether to keep some of the measures we took to help people along through the pandemic, are we better or worse prepared for knowing what to do next time something crazy like this happens?
I hope we're better prepared. I mean, one important lesson is that if we're faced with major crisis, we need to be looking to the fiscal side. We need to be looking to Congress for swift action. And it is the public sector that can mobilize the resources. Clearly, we're working in a political environment that is quite antithetical to increasing public investments, an environment in which, you know, public administrative structures that acted very effectively during the COVID pandemic are being under attack. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. But in terms of economic policy, I would say a lesson would be the fiscal arm is the one that can act, and it needs to act perhaps in a more surgical way to improve in a long-term manner the problems in the labor market, increasing minimum wage, providing essential benefits, dealing substantively with the accelerating healthcare costs, child poverty. These are the sorts of things that we saw even during the last election. I think these were the lessons that we can be learning going forward.
Pavlina Chernova is president of the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College, where she's also a professor of economics. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Rock and roll, yeah. Rock and roll, roll and rock away. Up and down, round and round, we'll sway with each swell in the spell of the rolling, rocking rhythm of the sea. Rock and roll and rock along. Life is sweet, greet it with a song while we dance. There's romance. Rolling, rocking rhythm of the sea. Tonight the moon hangs low. All tide or overboard will go. Rock and roll like a rocking chair. Laugh and smile while we drown each care.